The Sunstone Foundation presents The Swearing Elders, recorded live at the 1985 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 21st through the 24th. We take you to the Westin Hotel, Utah, in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
You to this Saturday morning session and tell you how much we appreciate you coming out on a Saturday morning. And I think we have a really fine subject that is very relevant to this whole symposium. It relates to a group of people who held their own, should we say, mini symposiums, and maybe started us on the road to this sort of thing. The main speaker is Tom Blakely. He did his undergraduate work in philosophy at the University of Utah, and currently he's a first-year student at the University of Utah Law School, not BYU. He has written an article entitled Utah's Runaway Government Officials in 1851, which was published in Utah Forum. He's married and has two beautiful boys. And he will be commented on, or his article will be commented on, by Richard Paul, who himself is a former swearing elder. And now a high priest, that's right. And he's been a professor of history at BYU. He's a professor emeritus of history at Western Illinois, and I think at least my first introduction to him is the author of what I consider and most consider a most important piece that introduced us to the Liahona Saint versus the Iron Rotter. And he's past president of the MHA and general editor of a book called Utah's History. And with that, we'll get started.
Thank you very much. I'd like to start off my talk, first of all, by issuing a caveat, and that's that this is the story of the swearing elders told by the swearing elders. There are numerous quotes in here, and the quotes can get to be rather lengthy. I will be starting off the quotes by saying, quote, and I will be ending off the quotes by saying, close quote. So everything in between will be a quote. This all started for me back in 1984 when I read the famous book, America's Saints, by Gottlieb and Wiley. There was one paragraph in there. It said on page 238, while McMurrin, referring, of course, to Sterling McMurrin, was warding off excommunication attempts, he and other like-minded intellectuals established in the 1950s a more formal setting for their network of Mormon independents. Calling themselves the Swearing Elders, the group explored in critical fashion a number of historical, philosophical, and doctrinal issues directly or indirectly related to the Church. Even the excommunicated Fawn Brody and other outcasts, such as Juanita Brooks, were invited to the sessions, as this high-powered assortment of Mormon intellectuals defined both the strengths and limits of the independent tradition of Mormonism as it existed in the environment of the Church of the 1950s. That's everything this book has to say about the Swearing Elders. At the time, I was taking a class from Dr. McMurrin called Early Christian Thought, and I posed a question to him one day after class, who were the Swearing Elders? And the paper is a result of that. In the 1980s, there are many forums for Latter-day Saints with scholarly leanings to air their opinions. Dialogue, Sunstone, the Journal of Mormon History, BYU Studies, the Sunstone Theological Symposium, and several other organizations and magazines fill this need admirably. But it has been, and still is, difficult for an individual to make his or her reasoned argument heard in the Church. One thing that makes these organizations either appealing or unappealing is the amount of education the reader has. Certainly there are other factors, other important factors, but it would seem that these organizations have only appeared since there have been a large number of Latter-day Saints educated in secular colleges and universities. Certainly before World War II, there were several Mormons that were educated in secular universities, notably E.E. Erickson, Russell Swenson, Heber Snell, and so on. But it was the post-World War II period that produced LDS men and women educated at secular graduate schools in significant numbers. At the time when these people were completing their studies, there were no real outlets for the intellectual to discuss any aspect of the Mormon culture and the Mormon religion outside of informal study groups. One of these study groups functioned in Salt Lake City and was known as the Mormon Seminar, or informally, as the Swearing Elders. What made the Swearing Elders different and important is the subject of this paper. In the winter of 1948-49, a University of Utah PhD candidate in sociology named Herbert Larson approached a new professor in the philosophy department named Sterling McMurrin on behalf of himself and other graduate students and junior faculty members to try and get Dr. McMurrin to teach a course in Mormon theology. Dr. McMurrin's answer was something like this, quote, "Now, Herb, you guys are big boys now, and you don't have to have a class in Mormon theology. You should have known all there is to know about Mormon theology by the time you graduated from high school," close quote. Dr. McMurrin, while discouraging a formal class in Mormon theology, felt that if those interested wanted to get together and have their time spent in a worthwhile manner, they should forget trying to have a meeting with one teacher or with a certain subject discussed. The approach, Dr. McMurrin felt, should be obvious. Quote, "Find the people who know something, whom you'd like to bring in. See what they know and have a go around," close quote. The subjects could range from sociology to philosophy to theology to history, and there could be complete freedom to do what they wanted and to invite who they wanted. This idea appealed to Larson, but when the group finally got around to meeting together, for about the first year, the meetings were subject-oriented, and Larson served as the coordinator and the chairman. Dr. McMurrin attended these meetings along with others, a few of whom I see in the audience, such as William Mulder, Obert Tanner, Waldemar Reed, Lowell Benyon, and T. Edgar Lyon. The group never had a formal name. Most often they were called the Mormon Seminar. The noted sociologist Lowry Nelson, who was on campus from the University of Minnesota as a visiting professor, came to the second meeting of the group, and it was he who nicknamed the group the Swearing Elders. Dr. McMurrin never really told me the reason why he called them the Swearing Elders, other than that he chuckled, shrugged his shoulders, and said, well, maybe there was some swearing going on. The group also had no formal organization or membership. People came to whatever sessions they wished to and missed those that they did not wish to attend. Again, it was a very informal arrangement. There was no membership, no dues, or anything like that. Herb Larson decided to leave in the fall of 1950 for a teaching position at the college in Price, Utah. This seemed to spell the end of the group in the minds of most of the attenders, but the institute instructors, Lowell Benyon and T. Edgar Lyon, who were in these sessions, felt that the group was a good thing, since their positions at the institute precluded them from taking leadership positions in any group like this. They asked McMurrin and William Mulder to take charge. McMurrin and Mulder agreed to and started the group on the footing that it has stayed on until it finally dissolved in about 1955. McMurrin and Mulder instituted two major changes for the group. First, it became speaker-oriented, as Dr. McMurrin had first suggested. Second, only professors were invited to attend the meetings. No students were allowed to participate in order to allow the professors complete freedom to say what they wished. At times, Dr. McMurrin told me they'd have to turn away students at the door who had hitchhiked all the way from Provo, because the BYU professor said, well, if the students are in here, I won't have freedom to say what I want to. The only real leadership that McMurrin and Mulder provided were in the decisions, in consultation with others, of whom to invite to speak, and to send out invitations to the regulars and others who might be interested. The group soon attained a sort of notoriety, and professors from other universities in Utah asked if they could participate. They were welcome, of course, and the group filled up not only with University of Utah faculty, but scholars from Weber College, Utah State Agricultural College, and many from BYU. The meetings were formatted in the following manner. Mulder and McMurrin would take suggestions as to whom to invite, usually a person who had published a book dealing with Mormonism or had finished a Mormon-oriented thesis, and they would ask the author if he would be willing to come and speak. The speaker would present his ideas, and a question and answer period would follow. Everyone was encouraged to participate, and it was an open, friendly environment. The reason many of the participants came from BYU was because of the freedom they had to express their thoughts. Dr. Brigham Madsen, who was a regular attender of the meetings and a BYU professor at the time, said that, quote, "At BYU, we didn't have quite the freedom that the people at the University of Utah had about discussing such things, and yet we had an interest in them. We wanted to hear people who knew something about Mormon history, Mormon theology, and who were not afraid to speak their minds. Here was a way to listen to such people, having an intellectual freedom that we did not have at BYU. So we were attracted to the group." Close quote. The mailing list included the names of such Mormon academics as Heber Snell, Joseph Geddes, Leonard Arrington, Jennings Olson, Lynn Bennion, Russ Mortensen, Angus Woodbury, Stanley Ivins, Obert Tanner, Waldemar Reed, Charles Dibble, Everett Cooley, Ray Canning, Brigham Madsen, Parley A. Christensen, Richard Paul, Golden Taylor, Gustav Larson, Lowell Bennion, T. Edgar Lyon, George Boyd, Leonard Rice, Russell Swenson, and others. The speakers invited to meet with the group, to lecture and to discuss topics of particular interest, included local teachers and scholars as Stanley Ivins, who spoke on the history and sociology of polygamy, Louis Zucker, a non-Mormon who spoke on the Old Testament ideas, an unknown person named Leonard Arrington, who spoke on early Mormon economic history, Harold T. Christensen, who spoke on the isms of Mormonism, Hugh Nibley, who gave a defense of the Book of Mormon, and Jack Adamson, who spoke on legends of gold plates in 19th century America. As occasion provided, there were lucky encounters with notable writers and scholars who happened to be passing through and agreed to speak to the group. Among them were Carl Carmer, who spoke on the history of Joseph Smith's New England, Bernard DeVoto, who spoke informally on the West in literature and history, Wallace Stegner, Whitney Cross, who spoke on his book, The Burned Over District, Thomas F. O'Day, Juanita Brooks, and Samuel W. Taylor. Two LDS general authorities were also involved with the group. Levi Edgar Young attended some of the sessions, and the group had the pleasure of having Apostle Adam S. Bennion speak to them on the problems confronting LDS college teachers. Recalling the group, Dr. Ray Canning said, quote, "Most of the group were quite congenial and quite friendly, with lots of good fellowship and good humor. And the idea of the swearing elders, well, nobody cared about the swearing, and nobody cared about the elders. But it sort of said something, that this was a group of people who were more relaxed in Mormonism, and certainly more on the liberal side than on the ultra-conservative side of the Mormon theological and political spectrum, and therefore more apt to look at Mormonism naturalistically as well as supernaturalistically. Some of them were very concerned with the supernatural side, but more often historically or philosophically or sociologically oriented. And they would raise these kinds of questions, rather open questions. Some of them scholarly questions, some of them questions of opinion, some of new documents being found, all kinds of things of that nature. So it was just fun." Dr. Bill Mulder also had some fond memories. Oh, close quote at the end there. Dr. Bill Mulder also had some fond memories. Quote, "I think if anything marks the swearing elders, it was a healthy skepticism about anything the brethren, early or late, uttered. And the last resort was always a sense of rationality, the attempt to be rational about everything. It was a liberal group that enjoyed meeting with each other and talking about issues and providing a sense of community. The realization that there were minds also grappling with questions historical, theological, social. We had wonderful points of view and backgrounds to draw on. Sterling and Waldemar in philosophy, historians like Brig Madsen and Everett Cooley, someone out of literature like me, a sociologist like Ray Canning. So it was stimulating to have people with these different disciplines talking about particular things." Close quote. Dr. Obert C. Tanner wrote that the swearing elders were, quote, "a group of devoted Mormons who went over the mountains and on our return wanted to compare with each other what we had found out." Close quotes. By 1955, the group was starting to get a little old, at least to McMurrin and Mulder. They had other things to work on. Mulder was the editor of the Western Humanities Review, and McMurrin was the dean of the graduate school. So the group, some of them joining the now infamous Angus Woodbury group. The probing and questioning of intellectuals like the swearing elders was met by the church authorities with some resistance and probably some confusion. The group of people who posed the clearest threat, they felt, were these professors, because they could corrupt the youth of the church. Dr. McMurrin was especially suspect because, as Dr. Mulder put it, quote, He was the grandson of one of the first presidents of the 70s. He had a special genealogy there, and they were concerned about a man as bright and as respected as him, and what his position was, close quote. Dr. McMurrin was invited by Joseph Fielding Smith and Harold B. Lee to visit with them in the summer of 1952 to discuss several things, one of which was the swearing elders. McMurrin remembers, quote, "The letter from Apostle Lee inviting me to meet with them was very strange. He said that he and Apostle Smith would like to discuss with me the meetings which were being held at the university for the purpose of criticizing us." That's quoting the letter that he got. "I realized that he referred to the meetings of the swearing elders, but I was astounded that he would say, for the purpose of criticizing us. By us, I thought he must mean the general authorities of the church. The amazing thing is that during our discussion it became evident that he thought we were holding these meetings for the purpose of criticizing Joseph Fielding Smith and Harold B. Lee." Close quote. The meeting between McMurrin and Lee and Smith was entirely cordial, and near the end of the three-hour session, Dr. McMurrin got to the heart of the matter. Quote, "I raised a question with President Smith and Apostle Lee as to whether or not they were getting, as to whether or not what they were getting at was that we shouldn't be holding these meetings. I didn't give them any reason to think we were going to discontinue them. As a matter of fact, I was getting a little tired of them, but after this session it became necessary to continue them because we couldn't give them the idea we'd stopped holding the meetings because of their raising some questions about them." President Smith was very anxious to make the point that by no means did they want us to discontinue holding the sessions. And then Apostle Lee came forth with his idea. He agreed with President Smith. They didn't want to see us discontinue these meetings. In my opinion, they did want to see them discontinued, but they weren't about to say that. Apostle Lee said, and now he's quoting Apostle Lee, "What we'd like you to do, Sterling, we know that you understand the doctrines of the church, and you know what the church thinks, what's good for the church, and what's bad for the church, and you have charge of these meetings. What we'd like you to do, couldn't you do this, that at the close of every meeting you sum things up, give a kind of summary, and then say, now then, the position of the church is such and such. We've heard this and we've heard that, but let me remind you that the position of the church is, and then you give them the position of the church, so they fully understand what the church's position is. When they go away from the meeting, there can be no misunderstanding of that. Couldn't that be done? Wouldn't that be an appropriate thing to do?" Well, I told him that that would be absolutely impossible. I said, "Apostle Lee, these people know the position of the church just as much as I do. These are professors at the Brigham Young University. Half of them were teachers at BYU. Some of them are old enough to be my father. They have been in the church for years. They know what the position of the church is. It would be presumptuous of me to do a thing like that. I couldn't possibly do it. Besides, if I were to do it, that'd be the end of the whole affair. They're not going to come there and hear somebody give them a warning before they go home that they must be sure to keep in mind what the church teaches. They know what the church teaches." When I got through stating my case, nothing more along that line was said. For general authorities who are accustomed to telling people what to think and expecting them to do it, it was very difficult for them to get the feel of what the swearing elders were all about. But I think they did get the idea that this would be an inappropriate thing to do. Close quote. Surprisingly enough, sometime later, McMurrin was the topic of a bizarre discussion led by a woman who was at a social gathering with Dr. Canning. Dr. Brigham Madsen was also there, and he can verify this. As he recounts, quote, "We were sitting there just chatting about odd things when this particular woman began to talk. These were her terms. About an antichrist in Salt Lake City who had a blood cult dedicated to the destruction of the church." Now, there are three extremes in a row. Antichrist, blood cult, destruction of the church. And I listened to this, and I was really amazed to hear this kind of talk. And I didn't put it together with the swearing elders at all, or with any personality. And finally, after she had stopped telling us all these horrible things about the group that was really subversive, I said to her, "Who are you talking about? You know, Antichrist, I'd like to find out about this. Dangerous stuff." "Well," she said, "it's Sterling McMurrin." Close quote. Dr. Canning told her that Dr. McMurrin was hardly the monster that she made him out to be, and said, quote, "You know, I don't question your sincerity. Obviously, you're sincere. Obviously, you believe this. But," he said, "it's false." And he said, "You must have gotten it from a very poor source." Close quote. Well, her source was her father, who was a very prominent general authority. This angered her, and she informed him of who her source was. Dr. Canning then remembers, to settle the whole thing right down, she said, "Of course you know that Sterling McMurrin is up for excommunication." She thought this would take care of the whole thing. And I said, "You know very well that has been stopped by President David O. McKay." And her retort really chilled me. Her exact words were, "Yes, but that's just temporary." You got the impression that David O. McKay wasn't going to last forever. Then they would do it. Close quote. The most memorable meeting of the Swearing Elders, and one of their last, the meeting that is most often associated with the group, was the debate that was held between Jennings Olson, professor of philosophy from Weber College, and Melvin Cook, the explosives expert and professor of metallurgy from the University of Utah. The subject of the debate was the merits, or lack thereof, of the then recently published work, Man, His Origin and Destiny, written by Joseph Fielding Smith. It was a large work, and if you remember, it has a very anti-scientific bias to it. Smith was given technical assistance with the book by Dr. Cook, who had written the introduction to the book. The meeting was held on November 13, 1955, in the little theater upstairs in the old Student Union building. I believe that's 1954. Word had gotten out that the meeting was taking place, and many people wanted to attend, including some LDS general authorities. The general authorities that showed up were Milton R. Hunter, Bruce R. McConkie, and Mark E. Peterson. Dr. Madsen remarked, Brigham Madsen, that, quote, "It was just one of the most interesting meetings we ever had because the debate was hot and heavy," close quote. And indeed it was. Jennings Olson defended the evolutionists and the geologists, and Dr. Cook defended Joseph Fielding Smith and Smith's rejection of both evolution and the estimation of the age of the Earth by the world's leading geologists. Both Dr. Jennings Olson and Dr. McMurrin gave me a vivid account of the end of the meeting, when Bruce R. McConkie was making several points that he felt were important to get across. Dr. Olson was amazed, he said, to hear the argument that Elder McConkie was offering. Olson reported that McConkie was saying that if everything that was said in the meeting about the age of the Earth, evolution, etc., was true, then Mormonism would fall. We know, McConkie said, that this is not the case. Mormonism is true. Therefore, what the scientists have to say about evolution and the age of the Earth is false. As Dr. McMurrin recalls, quote, "He was there as a defender of the book," McConkie, of course, a son-in-law of President Smith and one of the general authorities of the church. He had already spoken a time or two. The time was getting very short. Everyone wanted to say something. As a matter of fact, the janitor told me that they needed to lock up the building. There was only a very few minutes left, so I rationed out the time and told those who spoke that they could only have a very short time. I don't know, 2 minutes, possibly 3 minutes. But Bruce went on and on. I mentioned to him that his time was up and pointed to my watch. Finally, when he wouldn't sit down, I stood up. As I stood up, he said, "Now listen, Sterling." And I said, "Now you listen to me, Bruce. Your time is up, and I want you to sit down, so you sit down." So he sat down. I mention this, quoting Dr. McMurrin, I mention this only because I want the record to show that, so far as I can recall, this is the only time I ever told one of the general authorities of the church to shut up and sit down. I doubt if I'll ever have the occasion to do so in the future, close quote. The story that Dr. McMurrin related about Elder McConkie was told to me in January of this year. Because Elder McConkie has since passed away, Dr. McMurrin asked for it to be deleted from the text. Please report this to him, Mrs. Jacobson, that I said that. It remains, though, because I felt that it was an important incident. It's a very clear example of the kind of misunderstanding that went on between the swearing elders and a few of the general authorities. It was the old fight of the reasoned word versus the revealed word. Following the meeting, Dr. Richard Paul, a historian from BYU and a frequenter of the swearing elders meetings, received a letter from Joseph Fielding Smith, which said, quote, this is the entire body of the letter, "I am informed that you were at Sterling McMurrin's anti-Mormon seminar, November 13, 1954, and took part in the criticism. I wonder if you were properly quoted," unquote. To this letter, Dr. Paul responded, quote, "I did attend the Mormon seminar on November 13, being one of the more or less regular participants in the group's gatherings." Excuse me. Among these mature Latter-day Saints, none of whose church standing has, as far as I am aware, been called into question, I have occasionally commented on controversial aspects of our history and doctrine in terms which I would not regard as appropriate in my university or Sunday school classes. I expressed an opinion of your book on this occasion, though I assure you there was no pleasure in me for me in so doing. Close quote. President Smith wrote back to him, saying, quote, I am sorry to learn that you are, then quoting his letter, one of the more or less regular participants in the group's gathering. You say that they are, quoting the letter again, mature Latter-day Saints, none of whose standing has, as far as I am aware, been called into question. If you are a frequent participant in the group's gatherings and have the spirit of discernment, you must realize that they are not in harmony either with the authorities or the doctrine of the church. Close quote. President Smith ended the letter on a conciliatory note with the hope that they could meet sometime soon after that and get, quote, nearer together in our views, unquote. This meeting of the Mormon Seminar, or the Swearing Elders, is important because it was typical of the misunderstandings that some of the church authorities had in dealing with intellectuals like the Swearing Elders. In this drama, this clashing of epistemologies, there are no real heroes and there are no villains. There's simply a lack of meaningful communication. It's obvious that the Swearing Elders were misunderstood by several general authorities. I've been surprised as to learn how much these church authorities were opposed to the group. Why was their response like that? Why did they feel the group was harmful? A major factor appears to be secular education. When a person learns a secular discipline, be it philosophy or history or whatever, isn't it natural that they not only apply the discipline to their jobs, but also to everything in their life, including their church? As Dr. William Mulder so eloquently put it, quote, usually we felt that, institutionally, the church was hardly answering to the needs of the intellectual. We were not forming a congregation or a church or a cell or anything. We were just free-floating spirits who happened to be in academia and wanted to apply the same kind of discipline that they exercised in their own calling to questions of the Spirit. Close quote. Dr. Thomas F. O'Day researched his remarkable book, The Mormons, during the time the Swearing Elders were active in holding meetings. He spoke to the group and was writing on the basis of what he had learned from this high-powered group, and, of course, several other things. His conclusions about the conflict between intellectuals and authorities are insightful. He wrote in this book, quote, perhaps Mormonism's greatest and most significant problem is its encounter with modern secular thought. This encounter presents itself in terms of a specific dilemma that may be phrased education versus apostasy, and has created an unhappy intellectual group among the Mormons today. Close quote. This group he refers to may not specifically be the Swearing Elders, but the Swearing Elders typify the kind of group that O'Day is remarking about. O'Day further writes that, quote, the intellectual in his creative aspects is necessary to the maintenance and progress of society, for it is he as creator who produces widely shared and appreciated benefits, ranging from the realm of values to that of physical comforts. Yet the intellectual is also given to reflection and criticism. He also questions. As a questioner and critic, he not only annoys conservatives, but may come to threaten, or at least appear to threaten, cherished beliefs, values, and institutions. The intellectual often makes himself resented and becomes a target of aggression. Close quote. The generation that spawned the Swearing Elders was the first generation of educators being taught in large numbers at secular universities. Since then, every decade has added a considerable number to the field of Mormon intellectuals. This has been called, quote, the Swearing Elder Syndrome, close quote, by Dr. James Clayton. As the number of LDS college graduates grow, so also grows the need for a forum to discuss intellectual issues. For the 1950s era, the Swearing Elders came into being. Dialogue came onto the scene in the 1960s, Sunstone and the Mormon History Association in the 1970s, and these symposiums in the 1980s. Dr. Brigham Manson remarked that letters such as the Salamander letter that was recently disclosed are items that will be found with more and more frequency now that there are literally thousands of Mormon historians looking for such documents. Has been made by some scholars that the church should simply allow the vaults to be open to historians and to allow the truth to speak for itself. But those who advocate this approach do not understand the motivations and mindset of general authorities who react to secular methods in the same manner as Joseph Fielding Smith and Harold B. Lee. What appears to have occurred in Mormon culture is a paradigm shift. What, you may ask, is a paradigm shift? A paradigm, according to Dr. Neil C. Gillespie, is, quote, a synthesis of sufficient scientific merit to draw practitioners away from rival theories, which functions as a source of future methods, questions, and problems. When anomalies which inevitably arise out of research reach a certain intensity, thereby initiating a crisis, a change in paradigm occurs. Now, let me translate that. What Dr. Gillespie was writing of was a paradigm shift that occurs in scientific thought. One occurred at the time of Charles Darwin, in which a paradigm of creationism changed to a paradigm of evolutionism. It hasn't changed completely, and they are still clashing. What I postulate has occurred is a paradigm shift in religious thought, which is to say that each of us intrinsically possesses a set of epistemological givens, metaphysical baggage, so to speak, which serves as a guide to interpret our experiences and what meaning we assign to them. It consists of the assumptions that we all have that allow us to understand what's going on around us. For example, this is an example given to me by Dr. McMurrin. If you see a person in spasms rolling about on the floor, a person from the time period of Joseph Smith might say, let's put our hands on that man's head and give him a blessing, he's possessed by demons. A man in the 1980s might say, he's having a grand mal fit and a seizure, we should get him to a doctor, or at least keep him from biting his tongue off. A person in the year 2080 might say something completely different. I contend that secular education was one of the factors which led McMurrin and the Swearing Elders to reject the paradigm exemplified by Joseph Fielding Smith, if indeed they ever ascribed to it, in favor of a more tolerant and rational paradigm which saw the truth in a very different way. The paradigms of Joseph Fielding Smith and Harold B. Lee are completely different paradigms than those of Sterling McMurrin and the Swearing Elders. The difference constitutes a shift in a part of the Mormon culture that was not recognized as valid by the other. Dr. Bill Mulder aptly described it when he stated, quote, it was quite clear that there was a fundamental difference of point of view about doctrinal matters, and it was again the revealed word as opposed to the reasoned word, close quote. When viewed as such a deep-seated conflict, it is not remarkable that some of the general authorities viewed the Swearing Elders as heretics and apostates. In fact, it would be surprising to me if they did not. Their paradigms were so vastly different and clashing as to make meaningful communication almost impossible. The paradigm of these general authorities was consistent with the notion that, quote, excuse me, when our leaders have spoken, the thinking has been done, close quote. Truth is with a capital T, and those who disagree with their assessment of the truth were wrong. Now, I don't wish to make the mistake of saying that all general authorities exist in this type of paradigm. I think we can agree that Hugh B. Brown, Adam S. Bennion, and Neil Maxwell all do not fit this epistemological mindset. The paradigm of Swearing Elders, on the other hand, saw the truth as to be something relative, leaving everything open to question, down to the most basic assumption. But it was hard for the Swearing Elders to... It was as hard for the Swearing Elders to understand the paradigms of the general authorities who objected to them as it was for those general authorities to understand the Swearing Elders. But certainly the Swearing Elders saw the realm of experience in a much wider light than did these general authorities. And they were a part of a movement that's represented here and in Washington, D.C. as the Sunstone Theological Symposium, in Kansas City, Missouri as the Mormon History Association, and so on. But is there any more tolerance now than there was in the 1950s? I think we'd like to think so. But I read from the conference talk given by Elder Boyd K. Packer in April of 1985. Quote, there is another area where caution means safety. There are some who, motivated by one influence or another, seek through writing and publishing criticisms and interpretations of doctrine to make the gospel more acceptable to the so-called thinking people of the world. If their spirits are and their motivations are worthy, they will do no harm either to themselves or to others. If they are not, we would all do well to follow Paul's admonition and from such turn away. Close quote. I'm sure that the spirits and motives being worthy is tied up with being faith promoting. And it's obvious that Elder Packer was referring to such organizations as Sunstone and Dialogue. Knowing that some general authorities refer to these organizations today as the enemy, It is possible that the church has not progressed as far as some may think in allowing the intellectual to understand the church in light of his knowledge since the 1950s. Thank you very much.
Three introductory observations. We were not conscious back in those days, 30 years ago, that we were making history. Two, at the time I was a member of the bishopric of the Oak Hills Second Ward. Three, remembered events, and those of you who know Sterling McMurrin will know that this is particularly true, never remembered events never lose anything in the retelling. The Mormon seminar of the early 1950s, sometimes denominated the Swearing Elders or Sterling McMurrin's Anti-Mormon Seminar, was, as Mr. Blakely's paper describes, an occasional informal gathering of academic eggheads, mostly LDS, to consider whatever topics its sponsors thought might be of interest. Most of its gatherings were in 1951 and early 1952, though the most historic event associated with it occurred late in 1954. It is remembered primarily for that 1954 meeting and for the fact that some of its key participants were, and are, significant and highly visible contributors to the intellectual tradition in Mormonism. Those who attended did not perceive themselves as involved in a unique, subversive, or even historic activity. Most of us knew that Sterling McMurrin and Obert Tanner were unpopular with some of the more conservative general authorities, but we also knew that they had the support of others, including President McKay. Tanner, as I recall, was just getting into the writing of what is surely one of the best Sunday school manuals ever, Christ's Ideals for Living. And McMurrin was producing some of his seminal essays on Mormon theology. When we gathered, however, it was not to hear them, but someone from the remarkably diverse array of insiders and outsiders who were invited to discuss something more or less relevant to LDS history or culture. Since most of my BYU records are in boxes unopened since our move to Illinois in 1970, I have been unable to check what I may have kept other than the file on the Olson-Cook debate. I remember missing most of the seminar meetings to which I received invitations, either because of schedule conflicts or because transportation to Salt Lake was not always available for a low-income, one-car-in-a-family assistant professor. I remember sessions with Tom O'Day, Louis Zucker, L.H. Kirkpatrick, and Louis Munch. I remember Stanley Ivins sharing his notes on polygamy, at a time when official church literature dismissed plural marriage as the practice of not more than 2 or 3% of the church membership. I remember the session when Apostle Bunyan talked about problems facing LDS college teachers and showed by his presence that such discussion groups as this were not impermissible. This was in 1954, after the group had met very infrequently for 2 years, and it did not lead to a sustained revival of activities. Blakely correctly notes that Sterling and Obert were developing other interests, and the same was true of Bill Mulder and other participants from the several Utah campuses. According to the list Mr. Blakely has provided me, only one meeting followed the Olson-Cook debate, not because anybody surrendered, but just because nobody scheduled anything or sent out invitations. I would like to say a few things about Mr. Blakely's thoughtful analysis of the significance of the Swearing Elders, and then tell you how the Olson-Cook debate led to the most significant encounter with general authorities that my wife Jean and I have ever experienced. The Mormon seminar, in my view, was not so unique. I find a tradition of open discussion of gospel topics in the history of the church and a different pattern of response than he implies. There were enough Orson Pratts and B.H. Robertses in the 19th century to engender discussion, even disputation, at the highest as well as lower levels. I have never understood the Kirtland School of the Prophets to be a gathering of devout believers sitting in rapt attention at the feet of the prophet. Nor have I understood the prayer circles in Nauvoo to engage only in rituals and listening for heavenly voices. The Polosophical Society of the 1850s generated enough diversity of viewpoints to upset Heber C. Kimball and Jedediah M. Grant. Self-improvement groups abounded in Pioneer, Utah. Animated discussion of a variety of topics with expert inputs are associated, for example, with the Wasatch Club, to which Orson F. Whitney and Heber J. Grant belonged in the 1880s. The evolution controversy at BYU in the early 20th century was partly caused by the professors taking their views to study groups and audiences off campus. As long as I can remember, groups who want to talk about Mormonism have gotten together in regular study groups. A prominent continuing example is the 55-year-old Canon Hinckley group in Salt Lake, to which some of the general authorities have belonged and in which they are not held in reverential awe. The intercollegiate makeup of the swearing elders may have been unique, but what they did and said was not. Nor was the LDS graduate of a secular university as rare and as late appearing on the Mormon scene as Blakely suggests. The early 20th century saw not only E.E. Erickson, Russell Swenson, and Heber Snell go through the experience, but there were people like James E. Talmadge, John A. Widso, Joseph F. Merrill, Richard R. Lyman, Stephen L. Richards, and Adam S. Benyon, who confronted the challenge of reconciling education and testimony, and their careers suggest no built-in institutional bias against either education or intellectuals in the church. In sum, the egghead has been present in every generation, seen as peculiar by some, distrusted by some, but accommodated and frequently utilized by the institutional church. Illustrative is the role that intellectuals and thoughtful discussion have played in the instructional programs of the church itself. To trace the lesson manuals of the church auxiliaries in the Melchizedek priesthood through the generations in which authorship was identified is to confront a who's who of the best educated men and women in the church, many of them academics. Many of these manuals, like the early seminary and institute texts, were designed to stimulate and motivate rather than indoctrinate and pacify. I can only imagine the lively discussions that B.H. Roberts' course of study may have engendered in these groups. I can testify personally about how exciting it is to help young people see the implications of gospel principles with the help of Obert Tanner's manual or Lowell Benyon's The Religion of the Latter-day Saints. I come now to the only point on which I take substantial issue with Blakely's paper. He speaks of paradigms and paradigm shifts. I grew up before these terms became popular, and I've never learned to be comfortable with them. But if paradigm means model and paradigm shift means model change, then I think he misperceives where the change has occurred. It is not on the intellectual side of the revelation-reason dichotomy, but in the institutional treatment of the dichotomy. The change can be rather precisely timed. It occurred not long after the Mormon seminar passed into history, and its vehicle was the correlation program. What elders Harold B. Lee and Joseph Fielding Smith did in the meeting with Sterling McMurrin and with the phenomenon of the swearing elders is what their predecessors of conservative leanings among the general authorities had done in preceding generations. They counseled with the perceived offenders, issued generalized warning in public addresses and private conversations, discussed the problem with their less concerned brethren, and ended up doing nothing prescriptive or definitive. The policy of more or less comfortable coexistence continued, even as it had after the Polosophical Society intellectuals found other channels for exploring their concerns, and the BYU evolutionists found other campuses and students for exploring theirs. What Elder Lee and those who were associated with him accomplished through the correlation program was to contain the intellectual threat by eliminating intellectual inquiry from the instructional program of the church. The correlation program launched about 1960 with the support of President Smith, then the head of the Quorum of the Twelve, and with the acquiescence of President McKay. There is no doubt that Elder Lee was the prime mover, but he had the support of most of his associates in the hierarchy and the assent of the rest. The original emphasis in correlation was on eliminating duplicating and inefficient programs, cutting costs, and avoiding the mixed messages that stakes and wards sometimes receive through different channels of communication from church headquarters. By the 70s, however, when Elder Lee became a counselor in the first presidency and then the president in his own right, it had become clear that a standardized and safe curriculum was to be the centerpiece of correlation. Elder Harold B. Lee, whom my wife and I have known personally, who performed the, known him to be a good and kindly man, who performed the marriage for one of our daughters, and who was helpful in connecting an injustice of which I'm personally aware, was a quintessential iron rod. Indeed, he flattered me by quoting some of my language in a sermon in a 1971 general conference that appeared in the Ensign under the title, The Iron Rod, and also endorsed the definition of a liberal in the church as, quote, merely one who does not have a testimony, close quote. For Brother Lee, the issue between people with answers and people with questions was that clear-cut. I do not wish to be understood as asserting that correlation was the only cause or the only consequence of the trend toward conservative authoritarianism in the institutional church in the last 25 years, or that Elder Lee was the only source of the correlation movement. But I do suggest that Elder Lee was the right man in the right place at the right time to influence and shape these changes, and that he will surely be remembered as one of the 10 most influential general authorities in the 155-year history of Mormonism. Certainly, correlation is the primary contributor to the sense of isolation, even alienation, that many reflective Latter-day Saints feel in church today. This can hardly be otherwise when the official instructional protocol church organizations are designed to prevent thoughtful discussions. Teachers, and in some organizations, class members, are provided with detailed manuals and charged not to go outside them, except to the scriptures and a very limited number of answer books. They are provided outlines with points to make, quotations to read, or to give members of the class to read, questions to ask, right answers to provide if they are not spontaneously forthcoming from the class, and conclusions to reach. They are admonished to bear testimony at the end, even as McMurrin was urged to testify at the end of meetings of the Mormon seminar. One result is that almost any literate Latter-day Saint can teach a class, which is an outcome not without merit in the fast-growing and far-flung church. Another result is that almost all manuals for adults are singularly bland, and almost all classes for adults are remarkably tranquil. Since the efficient block plan leaves no time for informal discussions between meetings, the kinds of discussion that Sunstone-style Mormons enjoy now take place almost entirely outside chapel walls. This, in my view, is the paradigm shift. I turn now to the aftermath for me of the Olson-Cook debate and my involvement with the swearing elders. Tom has told the story of the correspondence. What I said, in fact, in my allotted 1 minute was that to me the book Man, His Origin and Destiny was a tragedy because it would strengthen the faith of those who needed no strengthening while make it more difficult for those who had problems. As an outgrowth of the correspondence, an appointment was made during the Christmas holidays of 1954, and since Gene and I were both acquainted with President Smith for a number of years on a number of bases, one thing Sister Jessie Evans had worked for my dad before she went to work for Brother Smith. So it was a close and comfortable relationship. And so we went to Salt Lake on the appointed day. And on impulse, finding ourselves there somewhat early for the appointment, we thought, wouldn't it be interesting if we could talk with President McKay about this same subject? And so on impulse, we went to his office And it happened that he was free, and so we were permitted to go in, and we spent time with him, and then went directly from his office and spent time with President Smith. Sensing that this was, at least for us, an historic occasion, we wrote our memory of what had been said in summary form as soon as we got home. And I've kept these notes over the years. A very abbreviated version of them has been shared with a number of people over the years, that which simply highlights the conflict of interpretation of the book. But there are other items of interest, and so what I'd like to do with the time that remains is to read those notes. You're the first audience that has heard those notes, since all of the participants are now dead, it seems. Okay. Notes on a conversation with President David O. McKay in his office, 11 a.m., Wednesday, December 29th, 1954, on the subject of the book Man, His Origin and Destiny, President Dr. and Mrs. Richard D. Paul. Question was raised concerning the obligation of Latter-day Saint teachers in the light of the book's contents. President McKay said that the book has created a problem. Being written by the president of the Quorum of the Twelve, it has implications which we can appreciate. The book has not been approved by the church. We are authorized to quote him on that. The work represents the opinion of one man on the scriptures. President Smith's views have long been known. Striking the desk for emphasis, President McKay repeated that the book is not the authoritative position of the church. He does not know how it came to be chosen as a text for the seminary and institute teachers last summer, but the choice was unfortunate. Question was raised concerning the feeling of insecurity felt by many Latter-day Saint teachers. President McKay said that we have nothing to fear. One man has been earmarked for excommunication, but he is still in the church and is basically a good man. The president hopes there will be no open clash over the book because of what it would do to the church as a whole. Nevertheless, we need lose no sleep over this matter, either for the president or the present or the future. President McKay mentioned Cressy Morrison's Man Does Not Stand Alone and Lecompte Denoyer's Human Destiny as examples of how scientists have dealt with the problem of man, God, and nature. In his opinion, these are two of the outstanding books of this century. We do not have enough of the facts to take a definite position on evolution, but the concept is certainly not incompatible with faith. After all, the process of creation is going on continuously. He and Sister McKay saw it in the eruption of Mount Paracutin in Mexico, and the recent earthquake in Nevada produced one of the most spectacular manifestations of the creative process in recent times. President McKay concluded by stating that the Latter-day Saints accept the scriptures, but that every man must interpret them for himself. He repeated his advice that we lose no more sleep on this subject. Notes on a conversation with President Joseph Fielding Smith in his office, 11:30 a.m., Wednesday, December 29th, 1954. Same subject. President Smith began by remarking that he wondered if I knew what bad company I was in the Mormon seminar. He described Stick Sterling McMurrin as the leader of the group and a man completely without a testimony. The bishop had planned to institute excommunication proceedings when President McKay had intervened, expressing a desire to talk to McMurrin first. President Smith did not know what the outcome might be. My defense of the seminar was based on the fact that many shades of opinion are represented in the group, and that its meetings are not devoted to theological matters, but to reports and discussions of topics which are amenable to academic investigation. President Smith explained that he had long been concerned over the problem of evolutionist teaching and its effect on testimony, and that he had not published the book entirely on his own initiative. Two or three of the apostles and two members of the First Council of 70 had read the manuscript and urged him to publish it. While he did not state that it should be taken as the authoritative church pronouncement, he declared that he would be happy to retreat from any position taken in the book which could be shown to be contrary to the scripture. Question was raised concerning whether the gospel requires a literal acceptance of the scriptures. President Smith answered in the affirmative. Question was then raised concerning Eve and Adam's rib. President Smith stated that so little information was available on this subject that he did not touch upon it. Question was then raised concerning the adequacy of the scriptural references about three in all upon which the doctrine depends that there was no death on the earth before the fall. This is the doctrine which is chiefly at issue between the literalists and many geologists, biologists, and historians in the church. His reply was that these scriptures are unequivocal and sufficient for him. President Smith read extensively from the scriptures to demonstrate that the prophets had taught that the world was created according to the Lord's time in 7,000 years, that it was a temporal history of seven, that it had a, has a temporal history of 7,000 years, and that the millennium and the renewal of the earth as a celestial abode are imminent. The recent earthquakes were cited as evidence on this point. He pointed out from Scripture that all life existed spiritually before coming, being placed on earth, and repeatedly emphasized that God did not create death. Death is the consequence of the fall, physically as well as spiritually, and for all forms of life as well as the children of Adam. This belief was held to be basic to an understanding of the atonement of Christ. Though President Smith acknowledged that there were those in the church who apparently accepted the atonement without following the literalist explanation of creation and the fall. Asked if there was not difference of opinion on this subject among the general authorities, had not been since the early days of the church, President Smith stated that it is possibly true. He is also aware that many prominent scientists of the church, who have no desire to weaken the faith of members, young or old, do not share his views. Henry Eyring had recently spent 3 hours pointing that out to him without apparently giving President Smith opportunity to state his own case. Agreement was reached that teachers and leaders who seek deliberately to ridicule the scriptures and undermine confidence in the church are not entitled to approval or respect. Agreement was also reached that scientists can be as dogmatic as other folks, and that scientists who are dogmatically anti-religious are not good scientists. Question was raised several times during the conversation about the large number of teachers in the church who do not denounce or debunk, but who do not find it possible to accept all the doctrines which Brother Smith presents as fundamental. They very much desire to remain tentative in their opinions on these matters. President Smith expressed awareness of the size of the group and remarked that some of them apparently regard him as without competence in the field of science. He assured that he did not think that they should be excommunicated or barred from teaching. The conversation concluded with our affirmation that we belong to the group in the church who find it difficult to accept all the scriptures literally, but who are desirous of learning the truth and constructively serving the church. In the university environment, we are persuaded that the quest for truth flourishes best when the area is rather narrowly defined within which absolute truth is regarded as already known. President Smith approved of the idea, but pointed out that insofar as he is concerned, where the Lord has spoken through the scriptures, there is the truth. The hour and a half session ended on cordial terms. We left with the impression that President Smith was quite as concerned about justifying his own position as about criticizing ours. Since both sides are apparently on the defensive, we feel more optimistic about the possibility of peaceful coexistence.
Unfortunately, we've run out of time. If you're interested in obtaining tapes of this session, apparently they're outside the Bonneville rooms. Thank you for coming, and see you in the next seminar.